What about me? I've flown. I helped build the goshawk. Are you going to kill me? Of course not, Fever, said Wavy irritably. You're one of us. Now be sensible.
I am being sensible, said Fever. If you were sensible, you'd see that it can't work. If you really want to stop people thinking, you don't use guns or bombs. You use religion.
She waved one hand toward Maida and hurried on, not sure where her words were coming from or where this idea was going, but blurting it out anyway.
Look at this place. They don't even use engines.
Why not?
Because they think their goddess has forbidden it.
Out there to westward somewhere, beyond the sea, there's a whole continent waiting to be re-explored, but no one goes there because the gods have cursed it. Down south in Sagwa, they destroy every scrap of old technology they find, because they say it offends their god. All over the world, all sorts of good things are banned and forbidden in the name of one religion or another.
You don't have to hurt Arlo. Please don't. You can stop his ideas from being used. Just bribe a few priests.
It's the job of priests to control knowledge and stand in the way of progress. It's what they're for. Let them spread the word that the gods never meant us to fly. Wavy watched her with those scriven eyes of hers, those grey and golden eyes that seemed both more and less than human.
You are a clever girl, Fever, she said.
Fever went rushing on.
I'll go and talk to the Maiden's High Priestess as soon as we dock. I think I know how to make her listen, but you have to promise me that Arlo will not be harmed.
She knew what Arlo would have said if he had been able to hear her, that he would not want to live if he could not fly. But she did not care. All she cared about was that he be spared. Wavy looked away from her, toward the rail. Jonathan Hazel must have succeeded in tethering his boat alongside, for his nervous face had just appeared over the superglider's gunwale. The rest of him followed, hauled aboard by helpful sailors. And after a moment, Arlo came after him. Wavy watched the young man, watched the sea wind tousling his dark hair, the uncertain, winning smile that spread on his face when he saw Fever waiting there. "Oh, he is rather lovely," she admitted, and looked around, smiling at her daughter. "Very well. As long as he gives up his work, I shall tell Dr. Teal that he is not to come to any harm."
Chapter 29 Word from the Great Deep. By the time the supercollider had docked in Maida's outer basin, the sun was already past its zenith, and the cool blue shadow of the western wall lay across the Quadrado del Mar. The great driftwood temple of the sea goddess looked like a wreck on the floor of the ocean, with blue-robed priests darting in and out of its ever-open doors like inquisitive fish. Quite a crowd followed Fever as she walked toward it. Her mother and father, a squad of marines from the supercollider, and a whole shoal of Maidens, shopkeepers and gentry, dockers and children, and harbourside riffraff, who had been drawn to the quay to watch the strange new ship come in, and were eager now to see what happened when its passengers met Orca Mo. The priestess had been warned of their coming. Indeed, she had watched the fall of the goshawk and the arrival of the supercollider that morning from the temple's precincts, through a vast old telescope cased in mother-of-pearl. She had objected at first when the steam ram asked permission to dock, reminding the council that the goddess abhorred motorized ships. But when its captain sent word that he would like to make a large donation to the temple funds, she prayed for a while and came to understand that the goddess would not mind making an exception for the supercollider, just this once. She was waiting for its passengers at the top of the temple steps, dressed in all her regalia, with all the tentacles of her squid hat waving on the breeze. Fever, striding toward her across the cobble square, felt a quick, nervous fluttering in her stomach. Stage fright, the actors on the Lyceum called it. She stopped at the foot of the temple steps, looking up at Orca Mo.
"Why have you come here?" asked the priestess sternly.
"I have come," said Fever, but her voice was just a hoarse little whisper, so she had to start again. "I have come to ask for forgiveness." She wasn't an actress, and she'd always hated lies,
but she thought of Arlo, and the look that Arlo had given her as they parted at the foot of the supercollider's gangway, of disappointment and betrayal and despair. And she said, "I've come to ask the sea goddess to forgive me." And it sounded sincere. Orcomo smiled at her. Not a smile of triumph, quite a kindly smile.
"Then come in, child," she said, holding out one hand to Fever,
and the other to stop all of Fever's friends and followers who would otherwise have come with her up the steps. Shafts of dim blue daylight reached through skylights into the temple's dim interior, slanting down between barnacled wooden columns. All sounds seemed muffled. The distant voices of chanting priests were as vague and echoey as whale song. A water organ was playing softly somewhere. If you could let yourself forget how dotty it all was, thought Fever, it would be quite beautiful. Orcomo sat Fever down on a driftwood pew close to the altar and settled beside her. She studied the wound on Fever's face, the purpling bruises.
"You're already forgiven, child," she said. "The goddess has already forgiven you. I saw it all. You flew with the birds and fell into the sea, and our mother below chose not to let you drown."
Fever wondered how she knew all that. She couldn't possibly have been able to see through her telescope who the Goshawk's pilot had been. But probably part of the job of being a priestess was making people believe you knew everything, so she did not ask how the woman came by her knowledge.
"When you were under the waves," said Orcomo softly, "did the goddess come to you? Did you see her? She has been known to appear to those who fall into her realm, even to unbelievers."
Fever looked down for a moment at her hands, folded in her lap, then up again at the priestess.
"Don't do this," Arlo had shouted at her when he learned what Fever was planning. "You mustn't."
"Yes," she said. "I saw her." She could feel herself blushing, her ears warming up like twin electric elements. She felt sure that Orcomo would know she was just making this up. But when she looked into the woman's eyes, she saw only a wistful yearning. Orcomo longed to believe, and that made her easy to lie to, even for a novice liar like Fever.
"What did she look like?" urged the priestess. "How could you be sure it was her?"
Fever glanced up at the altar, where the statue of the goddess smiled down insipidly from its aquarium. It was the same age-old sacred statue that she had watched being carried on its litter across the lock gates at the blessing of the summer tides. Now it was back beneath the water, surrounded by bright shoals of darting fish, and on the white sand at its feet were the Maya Abagio's three sacred symbols, the bubbling clamshell, the treasure chest, and the skull.
"She looked just like her statue," said Fever. "Those blue and white clothes, the circle of gold above her head, exactly like that. But her eyes were green, and her hair was dark, and she had freckles."
"Freckles?"
"Freckles."
"And did she speak to you? Did she ask you to carry any message to us out of the great deep?"
"Yes," said Fever.
"You mustn't,"
Arlo had screamed at her. She had gone to see him in the supercollider's medical bay, where Wavy's surgeon was tending to his wounded arm. But when she told him what she planned to do, he had driven her away. "If people start believing flight is wrong, we'll be barred from the sky for centuries," he had shouted.
"Flight is possible. We've done it. The Goshawk flew. You can't murder the truth."
But Fever thought she would rather murder the truth than let the suppression office murder Arlo.
"What did she say to your child?" pleaded Orcomo.
Fever bowed her head. "She said that it was she who had made my flying machine fall, and that she was letting me live so that I could come to you with her message."
And what is her message? People are not meant to fly. That is one of the reasons why she smote the ancients with, smitey things. Because of all their flying machines dirtying the sky. Only the goddess may make flying things.
She broke off short, sure that she'd gone too far. Surely no one could believe this bilge. But Orcomo's eyes shone, filling like tide pools, spilling salt water down her cheeks.
Oh, yes, she said, taking Fever's hands in hers. Oh, yes, it makes such sense.
Does it?
Of course. The sky is her realm too, you see. Science has taught us that the air is mostly made of water. So what is the sky? But another sort of sea.
Well, that's not quite...
And does not even the moon herself obey the pull of the sea's tides?
No, it's the other way round, Fever started to explain.
Orcomo did not notice.
Pray with me, child, she said, pulling Fever off the pew, shoving her down onto the sea-worn planking of the temple floor, kneeling there beside her. We shall give thanks to our mother below for this new revelation. And then we shall go forth into the city and make sure that all of Maida knows her will.
But all Fever could think of was the last look that Arlo had given her. That empty look of shock and loathing. He'd been betrayed by Weasel, and betrayed by Thirza Blazy. And now he had been betrayed by Fever Crumb.
Chapter 30. Westering. 2 days later, the Lyceum rolled back into Maida, still garlanded with flowers from the fiesta at Merriam. The flowers were fading now, but Ruin and Fern had fresh, bright memories of their adventure, which they were eager to tell Fever about.
The dolphins in the harbour, the great walls of Merriam high as high, the fountains they had danced in by the light of the festival fires, the kindness with which the Caliph had received them, the way Ruin had worked all the lights and stage effects himself, without ever once burning the poor old barge to flinders, which Fergus Bucket had said he was sure to do. But they had no chance to tell Fever any of it, because she had news of her own.
That strange warship anchored in the outer basin had come from London just to find her. These people were her parents. This lady, tall and kind and beautiful, was her mother. This shy, quiet gentleman, her father. And what would that mean? What would happen now? When she told them, Fern started to sniffle, and Ruin couldn't even look at her. He had to go away and walk along the harbour side by himself. There was no one he could talk to about what he felt. How can you explain that you have a broken heart when you are only 10? But the show must go on. If he had learned anything in his 2 years with the Persimmons, it was that. So he went back to the Lyceum, back down into the crawl space under the stage that had become his now. He was determined to let Fever see how well he could work her lights. That evening, back on the waste ground behind the harbour, the tale of Neil Strongarm unfolded once more in the summer twilight, and this time Fever watched it from the audience, seated in the front row between her mother and father. She was worried at first that they might not approve of this make-believe world she'd spent the past 2 years in, but Wavy laughed at all the jokes and applauded at the end of every scene, while Dr. Crumb, who had never seen a play before, seemed quite fascinated. Fever was fascinated, too. She had never before really understood the strange alchemy that A.P. and his company could work. Now, although she knew the script by heart, she found herself moved by the improbable story, by the love of Celine for her astronaut, by A.P.'s voice, which served up slabs of poetry as rich and dark as fruitcake. By Laura Persimmon's Autumn Beauty, Lilibet's ballet, Max's and Dimp's clowning, by the excitement of the fights and battles, and most of all by the skilful way Ruin worked the lighting and effects, and by Little Fern.
AP had padded out the handmaiden's role with extra lines, and Fever realised that Fern must have been watching and learning during all her time aboard the Lyceum, for she could steal a scene as slyly as Cosmo Lightly, and ride a joke as well as Dymphna. And she knew that would make it both harder and easier for her when the play ended, and she had to go to AP and tell him what she had already told the children, that she would not be travelling onward with the Lyceum. Wavy and Dr. Crumb had already decided what would happen to her, and Fever had not had the strength to argue. She would be leaving with them on the morning tide, going back north aboard the Super Collider, and Fern and Ruin would not be going with her. It would not be fair, she thought, to take them from this summer country back to the snows and sloughs and smokes of London. They would miss her for a little while, she thought, but she had never really been a parent to them, or even a proper guardian. She had just been the person who delivered them to their new home, the Lyceum. And there, aboard the Lyceum, she must leave them, among all these good people whom they loved, and who loved them better than Fever had ever managed to. It might have been different if Arlo had been there with her. He might have given her the strength to stand up to Wavy and Dr. Crumb. She might have stayed on with him in Maida, or taken him with her aboard the Lyceum and let him be drawn into AP's messy, cheerful family. But Arlo had gone off alone as soon as the Super Collider docked, refusing to even look at her. Gone back to Casas Elevado, Fever guessed. And what would he do there? What could he do, with the goshawk gone, and the common folk of Maida so stirred up against the idea of flight that they were burning even their children's kites on the bonfires in the Cuadrado del Mar? Dr. Teal, rescued from Thursday Island by the Super Collider's launch, had taken Fever aside when he saw those fires and said, "I have to admit, Miss Crumb, you put the whole suppression office to shame. You've gotten the Sea Goddess to do our job for us. If this spreads, and I mean to make sure that it does, you'll have set back the development of flying machines by a generation." From the smile he wore while he said it, she gathered that she was meant to feel good about that. The play reached its end. The audience stood up, applauding, as the actors formed a line along the stage front, no longer characters out of the lost past, but just themselves again, holding hands, bowing, waving. "Extraordinary," Dr. Crumb was saying. "I had no idea." AP brought Fern centre stage and requested a special round of applause for young Fern Solent, who will one day be the brightest star of Bargetown. And then the division between actors and audience dissolved, and there was talk and laughter and drink and music, with Fever in the midst of it somewhere, being hugged by Dymphna and Lilibet and Cosmo. Ruin was showing Dr. Crumb the backdrops he had helped to paint and explaining to him about perspective. Dymphna was having a long and serious conversation with Jonathan Hazel. Wavy was flirting with AP, telling him, "You must come to London soon. If not, London must come to you." Fever, all unnoticed, walked away. Through the throng and racket of Bargetown she went, and then along the quays to the southern stair. Although it was so late, the light still lingered in the western sky, and above the crags of the eastern wall, a vast and sulphur-yellow moon had risen. All the way to Casas Elevado, she was working out in her head what she would say to Arlo. "I had to do it. Dr. Teal and my mother would have found a way to kill you otherwise. What I told Orcamo will be a 9-day wonder. It probably won't spread much beyond Maida. You'll be able to go to another city and start working again. One day people will fly." Or should she suggest that Arlo come back to London with her and offer his services to the engineers? But Arlo's fragile, beautiful machines had nothing in common with the huge, crude, all-devouring thing the engineers were building. Like Fern and Ruin, and all the good things in her life, he belonged in sunlight, not in London. And when she reached his house, she found that she was too late anyway. His gate was not just open, it had been torn from its hinges. Angry feet had tramped a broad path through his garden. His house stood smashed and vandalized at the bottom of its rails, its windows shattered, its walls daubed with religious symbols, slogans, threats. The followers of the Maya Bajo had not forgotten Arlo Thursday and his gliders. When they had finished burning all their kites, they had come for him. Fever wandered through the ruined, moonlit rooms. In the bedroom, the picture of her grandfather and Arlo's had been torn down, slashed and trampled, until the two men's faces were unrecognizable. Arlo's clothes had been ripped and flung about. Books had been torn up, the pages lying in thick drifts on the floors. The people who had done it probably couldn't read, and they'd imagined that these poems and stories were instructions for building godless flying machines. Fever began to cry. She had never really done it before, although she had sometimes felt like it. She'd always been able to control herself till now. But suddenly she was sobbing, sitting down in the wreckage of the kitchen where she'd sipped Arlo's coffee and listened to Arlo's plans. She let the salt tears flow out of her. When there were no more, she went outside. Wavy was waiting for her in the day-bright moonlight on the veranda. She looked at Fever's tear-stained face and said, "Surely, Fever, you knew this would happen. You of all people ought to know a bit about the madness of crowds."
"What have they done with him?"
asked Fever, feeling angry at herself, because she knew Wavy must have heard her sobbing and mewling in the kitchen. "Oh, Arlo wasn't here," said Wavy. "I seem to remember promising you that he wouldn't be harmed. I think Dr. Teal would have liked to interpret that as meaning that we would not harm him, and letting the Maidens do the deed for us. But that would have been cheating, don't you think? So I made sure Arlo went aboard his schooner yesterday night and stayed there. Some of our people sailed it for him from Thursday Island. It's moored in the Outer Basin."
"What will he do?"
"Leave, Maida, I imagine. After that, who cares? The suppression office will keep an eye on him, of course. But I doubt he'll ever get another of his flying machines off the ground. Not with so much feeling against it." She sighed, sensing Fever's unhappiness, searching for some way to comfort her. "Honestly, Fever, it's not your fault. Forget it. What are flying machines, anyway? Just toys for children. Wait until you see the new London. See the power of it, I mean. We'll walk together through the engine district, you and I. Those immense turbines, like the mills of God. You'll soon forget your silly aeroplanes." She smiled and reached out to rearrange Fever's hair. "He is a handsome boy, Fever, but he is not for you." Fever pushed her hand away and ran, back through the garden, along Casas Elevado, down a narrow stair to Rua Serculo. A restaurant was starting to descend, and Fever leaped aboard. Waiters came to show her to a table, but she waved them away, hurrying through the building, the diners all turning in their seats to stare at her. Some reached out to touch her as she passed, for luck. "That's the girl who flew, the girl the goddess spoke to." She ignored them, ran out onto the veranda at the far end, potted palms and bougainvillea, Chinese lanterns swaying in the breeze, the static buildings of the cliffside sliding by on either side. Below her, moonlight sprawled silvery across the waters of the harbour. In the outer basin, a schooner had raised its sail. She vaulted up onto the rail that ran around the veranda and balanced there, waiting for the restaurant to arrive at its lower buffers. The manager appeared behind her, pleading with her to get down, telling her that she was endangering herself and disturbing the diners. But Fever didn't care about the diners, and this didn't feel like danger, not compared to some of the things she'd done lately. When the buffers were still 6 feet away, she sprang across the narrowing gap, landed hard and ran, leaving the watchers on the veranda behind her to shake their heads and tell each other that her encounter with the Maya Bajo had deranged her wits.
"Arlo!"
she shouted, haring through the shadowed canyons between the warehouses. The Jenny Hanover's pale sail slid across a slit of moonlit water between two walls. Fever ran on, out onto the harbour side. It wasn't rational, but she needed to talk to Arlo before he left, to stop him leaving if she could.
If she could only get his forgiveness, then at least she would have salvaged something.
But the Jenny Hanover was making for the harbour mouth, and as she gathered speed and moved out into the wind-ruffled water beyond, a ghost-white storm of angels detached themselves from the bridges and cliffs and rooftops of the city and went soaring after her, surrounding her, wheeling around her masthead, flying low over her straight silver wake like gulls behind a trawler. Fever ran and ran, right out to the uttermost end of Maida's long mole. She could see Arlo at the schooner's helm, his injured arm bound up in the white sling the supercollider surgeon had given him.
"Arlo!"
she shouted. He did not look around, and Fever had no way of knowing if he was ignoring her or if he simply hadn't heard. She thought at first that he must be heading back to the Ragged Isles. But as the schooner cleared the harbour mouth, it turned due west. Where was he going? Maybe he didn't care. Maybe he just wanted the solitude of the open ocean. Maybe he wanted to die out there. It may be that the gulfs will wash him down, thought Fever, half recalling some fragment of verse from one of AP's poetry recitations. It may be he will touch the Blessed Isles. And it may be that he was going where the angels had gone of old, letting their atlas guide him to whatever forgotten coastlines lay beyond the sea's blue edge. And the angels were going with him. She could see skeins of them lifting from their eyries on the Ragged Isles, blowing like white banners across the sea.
Arlo!
She screamed, standing at the end of the harbour wall in the moonlight, the sea light in the spray of the steep salt waves.
Take me with you, Arlo!
But the schooner just kept on getting smaller, shrinking into the huge emptiness of night and sea and sky, taking Arlo and the mysteries of flight away from her. No more than a flash of white sail now, smaller than a handkerchief, smaller than a pillow feather. And after a while, when even her sharp, scriven eyes could not tell the Jenny Hanover from the white caps on the waves, Fever knew that she would never see him again. She turned away and started walking slowly back along the harbour side, toward the lights of the city and the black, waiting bulk of the supercollider. There was nowhere for her to go now, except home. This is Jenny Agata. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of A Web of Air by Philip Reeve. This programme was directed by Sarah Carouche and produced by Paul R. Gagne. Original music by Nick DiBerardino. Text copyright 2010 by Philip Reeve. Music copyright 2010 by Nick DiBerardino. Production copyright 2011, Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.